Hello, everyone. I'm Elisha Krause, and welcome to episode 4 of The Conversation featuring Daily Wire's own Ben Shapiro. He's my boss, so I have to be kind of nice, but I'm going to, can I get away with calling this the Christmas edition?
Yeah, sure. Well,
okay, here we go. The Conversation is streaming live on the Daily Wire website, the Ben Shapiro Facebook page, and the Daily Wire YouTube channel. And it will be available to download on SoundCloud like a regular podcast, so you can listen in the car and share it with friends later. It's free for all of our fans to watch and listen, but only Daily Wire subscribers get to ask the questions. So to ask questions, subscribe to the Daily Wire and log in to the website. Then ask your questions in the comment chat box, which we will answer in the order that we receive them. We promise that. That's one of the great things about The Conversation. Also, be sure to stay tuned to next month, Tuesday, January 16th, for the 5th episode of The Conversation, starring our very own Andrew Klavan, who throws a really good Christmas party, by the way, that you missed out on.
It's
the best way to kick off the new year. Well, it was after sundown, so I thought you might come.
Yeah, I thought so too, but I have 2 little kids and no babysitting.
I brought my kids.
Right, but that's because you have no taste.
No, he said that children were allowed because he likes, like, ornaments only hung at the 4-foot level around the tree.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
He actually, my 4-year-old had to go decorate behind the tree that was, like, facing the window, and she was very excited about that because she was the only one that got to go back there.
It's a good story.
I have a really dumb Gentile question to ask
you.
And I'm only killing time because we're waiting for real questions from subscribers to come in right now because I'm sure they're hastily logging in. Is there an equivalent of a Christmas tree for Hanukkah?
No.
No?
I mean, there's the menorah, but that was an actual, like, accoutrement in the temple.
Yes.
Right, so no, there's not, like, a random shrub.
So you're not going to make wreaths and hang them on the doors or anything?
No, we don't do that.
So you just have the menorah in the window?
Yes, right. We have the menorah in the window, okay. And then we don't actually go into our yard and, like, chop things off the bushes. And, like, anybody who talks about, like, the Hanukkah bush, not a Jewish thing. This is you being sad because you don't have Christmas, which I understand. Christmas is pretty awesome.
Christmas is pretty awesome.
But, I mean, it's a great holiday, but if you have to imitate the Christians by going out and chopping off a shrubbery and sticking it by your fireplace, then you're doing it wrong.
Well, there was the burning bush, but that's a totally different
thing.
So we have our first question, and you ready to roll?
Let's do it.
And try to get through as many as possible. Spencer asks, hey, Ben, were you ever unsure as to what you wanted to do with your life? When exactly did you decide to become a lawyer and then change to delivering political commentary full time?
So I actually never wanted to be a lawyer. So I first started off when I was 16, I went to college. Mm-hmm. And when I was starting in college, I thought that I was going to double major in music and genetic biology.
Wow.
And I walked on campus, and within the first few weeks, I had seen a piece. Two things happened. One, I took math for engineering majors, which was not great. And second was that I saw an editorial in the Daily Bruin, the UCLA paper, that was really an anti-Israel, anti-Semitic editorial. I walked into the office, I asked if I could write a counter, and that turned into a column I was writing every couple of weeks, and it sort of took off from there. So I didn't know that I was going to get into politics until then. And then when I went to law school, I really didn't want to be in law school. Mm-hmm. I was not interested in going to law school. My mom wanted me to be in law school because she basically runs business affairs for companies and had always regretted not getting her law degree. And then after I took the LSAT and did well and got into Harvard, she's like, you need to go. So. Mm-hmm. My career path was essentially set from the time that I was 17 or 18 years old, but it was very different from the career path I thought I was going to have when I was 16.
And do you have any regrets?
I mean, it depends on the political news cycle. When the political news cycle really sucks, I'm like, well, it'd be nice to be in a symphony. And then I realize what people in symphonies get paid. And then I'm like, well, I guess it'd be nice to be in politics.
And even how symphonies can be political, as we saw with our own friend Dennis Prager.
That is true as well. I'm not sure I would have survived being in a symphony.
Exactly.
I barely survived being in an office. So.
This is true. Dylan is asking, hey, Ben, you've talked a lot about Beethoven, but what do you think of Frederick Chopin? And I feel like I said that wrong.
You did. Chopin.
Sorry. And what's the next one?
And Claude Debussy.
I knew how to say that, but now you made me. Greetings from Switzerland. Oh, hey.
Sup, Switzerland? Okay, so
send us some chocolate
and cuckoo clocks. In any case, I'm not a huge Chopin fan, but I think you have to be a pianist to really be a Chopin fan. Everyone I know who's a huge fan of Chopin is a pianist. Debussy's different. Debussy's orchestrations are revolutionary and wonderful, and I love Debussy's music. I think Debussy's just spectacular.
So your dad is
he's a professional pianist. Yeah,
does he like?
He does like Chopin, although he likes. Honestly, when you're a professional pianist or professional violinist, there's sort of the difference between show pieces and more serious music. And Chopin sort of, from what he said anyway, sort of runs the line between show piece and serious music. And my dad tends to like more serious music. So if he's going to play, he likes Beethoven and Brahms and Bach and that sort of music. Chopin's a little more on the showy side.
So if somebody wanted to take a class that they could potentially learn you know, like cooking and music and all these extra skills? Because I feel like you have a lot of like side things that you enjoy doing as hobbies, but you want to make yourself better at these hobbies, right? Could they check out Skillshare.com?
They could indeed check out Skillshare.com for those things. This is the case. So, are you looking to get a leg up at work and take your career to the next level? With over 3 million members, more than 17,000 classes, Skillshare is the Netflix for online learning. Take classes in graphic design, DSLR photography, social media marketing, digital illustration, and much, much more. Skillshare classes, they're taught by industry experts, experienced professionals. They are perfect if you're looking to build your career or start the side hustle of your dreams. I took a class in watercolors, believe it or not, because that's just the kind of deep
fellow that I am.
Is that
what we're all getting from Hanukkah for you?
Watercolors painted by me?
Sure.
Yeah, those will sell for at least $7 on eBay. But you can also get social media marketing classes. That's one of the ones I'm taking. Skillshare gives my listeners a 1-month free trial of unlimited access to over 17,000 classes. Go to Skillshare.com/Shapiro. So it's Skillshare.com/Shapiro. And you start your free month today. Once you've started Skillshare, you're not going to want to stop because the learning, it just helps you broaden and deepen your resume. You get paid more. Makes sure that you have the skill sets necessary in order to make your career better and have a better trajectory.
So people are able to watch right now on YouTube and on Facebook and on thedailywire.com, but only our subscribers can ask the questions, folks. So if you're a subscriber, be sure to log in. We're taking questions as soon as they come in. We have another one right now from Eternal Genju. Howdy, what are your thoughts regarding the investor, George Soros?
So George Soros obviously is a radical leftist with a hard left agenda. He funds a bunch of groups in the United States who are not good for the body politic. Also, his history as an investor has been called into question before. He was supposedly single-handedly responsible for almost sinking the British pound at one point. Mm-hmm. He's a sketchy character, to say the least. But most of the sketchiness that is associated with Soros is associated with his political spending. He really does fund a lot of radically anti-American groups. And those groups are definite kind of sticking points in the cogs of democracy.
And they are sticking points in the cogs of like what was in the news cycle in 2016 and 2017.
Well, I mean, he's always, you know, a lot of the groups that Black Lives Matter groups have been mm-hmm. supported by George Soros. A lot of the Occupy Wall Street groups mm-hmm. were supported by George Soros. He is a radically left guy. There's no question.
Next, we have a question from Tom. Hi, Ben. What is your opinion on the proposed idea that race and IQ are linked due to genetics rather than environment?
So the evidence on race and IQ is mixed with regard to how much these are linked to genetics as opposed to environment. So that's never really been clarified because you have actually seen IQ movement in groups. So when, for example, the IQ test started to be used at the beginning of the 20th century, mm-hmm. Eastern European Jews tested very low on the IQ test, and then within a generation, they were testing very high on the IQ test. A lot of it has to do with education. A lot of it has to do with how well you speak the language. And also it depends when you're taking the test. So IQ tests are quite variable. A lot of the time, people take IQ tests when they're 3 or 4 years old, and those are not predictive. It's only when you get to 7 or 8 years old that IQ tests are actually predictive. And of course, it's necessary to point out that even if there was a group that had a lower IQ than another group, mm-hmm. that does not speak to individuals within the group and where they fall in the IQ chart, because individuals are individuals, group metrics are group metrics. So it doesn't really say a lot for what policies should be, even if there were differentials in IQ among various groups, whether you're talking men or women or whether you're talking racial groups. So any group that you pick, there's going to be some IQ differential because the people in it are not identical, and the chances that it averages out exactly the same are, you know, relatively low. But that said, the attempt by some to basically say that discrepancy in America or in any other country are generally caused by IQ difference as opposed to, for example, culture, I think that's a difficult road to hoe just because IQ does not directly correlate with income beyond a certain point, for example.
Okay, interesting. Al wants to know, hey, Ben, what's your response to leftists who say gender is disconnected from sex?
So one of the things that's really irritating about how leftists address gender and sex is that they like to redefine gender depending on the context in mm-hmm. which they're using it. So they'll say that sex, the honest leftists will say there's sex, which is biological, you're a man or you're a woman or you're intersex. And then they will say that there's gender, and gender is a social construct. So that's feminine or masculine.
Yep.
Okay, well, feminine and masculine are connected to biology, right? Men tend to be more masculine, women tend to be more feminine. Mm-hmm. There is a biological connection there. But what the left will do is they'll say gender is completely disconnected from sex. It's completely arbitrary. It's a social construct. And then they'll read back into sex what they want gender to be. So they'll say that gender has nothing to do with man or woman, but there is such a thing as feminine and masculine. These are social constructs, and you can push those back into sex. So now, biological sex no longer exists. Mm-hmm. A biological woman who identifies as a gendered man is actually a biological man, right? This is the way that the left likes to treat this, and it's insane. I mean, you can't conflate these terms. If you want to say that there are certain elements of societal constructs that are clearly socially constructed, like, for example, garment wear to a certain extent, mm-hmm. then that's fair. But if you want to say that it's not biological, like feminine and masculine attributes are utterly disconnected from sex, biological sex, there's no scientific backing for that whatsoever.
Especially when it relates to hormones.
Oh, for sure. I mean, again, it's such a bizarre world where doctors are being misinformed about the sex of their patient because the patients are being asked gender. Mm-hmm. Like, this actually happens on a relatively frequent basis where a doctor will enter a room. I know it's happened to my wife at least once, where a doctor enters a room and it says on the patient's chart that the sex is not what the sex of the person actually is. And the diagnosis is going to be very different. If you're having lower stomach cramps and you're a man, the diagnosis is very different than if you are having lower stomach cramps and you're a woman.
I'm just wondering, how long did we make it into the conversation before Ben mentioned his wife being a hot doctor?
Oh, that was like 10 minutes?
On your nice
new record.
Your nice movement.
My MVMT watch right there. Oh, yeah.
Lance says, hey, Ben, love the show. Why is it that the left is so quick to give up on their individual rights for the sake of the supposed public good? Do you believe they are ignorant of where this will end?
I don't think they're ignorant of where it'll end, but I think that they blind themselves to where it ends. I think that the left does not believe in individual rights. They believe that you are defined by your group identity. So if you are a Jew, then it is your membership in the Jewish group that matters. If you're a black person, then it's your membership in the black group that matters, because power can't actually be promulgated except by group dynamics. This is sort of the Marxist theory, is that if you are an individual, there's no way you can make your way in the world. You can't really act out in powerful ways in the world. You have to band together with other people, and so we have to identify you by your group. That's the only way that things get done. And so the left is very focused on things getting done in terms of what they call social justice, right? Even the term social justice evidences that they care very little about individual rights, because social justice is all about what's good for the group, not what's good for the individual, what's just for the individual.
So next question we have from Daniel. I'm trying to get through these as quickly as possible. Would Trotsky have been more dangerous leader if he had succeeded Lenin rather than Stalin?
If it's hard to imagine that somebody would have been more dangerous than Stalin, frankly. So, you know, Trotsky, the differences between the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks and the Trotskyites and the Stalinites.
And I feel like we're back to 2016 election talk.
Yeah, really. I mean, they look relatively minor, is the truth. When you look at the actual debates between Trotsky and Stalin, you know, it looks like Trotsky was radical, but not quite as violent as Stalin. Stalin was more violent, but not quite as radical as Trotsky. But in the end, it's very hard to say that somebody would have been a more dangerous leader than Stalin, given that Stalin ended up murdering 50 to 60 million people minimum. So that's a difficulty.
David says, hi, Ben. Happy Hanukkah. I wanted to know your opinion on this issue, as I've debated it with my stepdad. Is being a Jew racial, ethnic, or religious component of one's identity? Hashtag Shapiro 2024.
Okay, so
I had to get that hashtag in there.
I appreciate it. Okay, so racial, ethnic, or religious. Okay, so ethnic is, so it's not racial. Judaism is not racial. Mm-hmm. Even Jewishness is not racial. You can see that in the Jewish community. My wife is Moroccan. I am from Eastern European extraction. There are Jews from Ethiopia, so race has nothing to do with it. If you go to Israel, you'll see Russian Jews and you'll see black Jews, right?
Remember when we were on a radio show together and there was a black Miss Israel?
Mm-hmm.
And the American newspapers didn't know how to address her because
she was
Israeli.
Black, right, exactly. She's black, but she was Israeli and Jewish.
They were like, well, we can't call her black, but we can't call her African-American. And President Obama met her, and they were like, what do we say?
Right, exactly. And the answer is she's a black Jew. I mean, she's a Jew from Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. So race has nothing to do with it. Ethnicity, being Jewish is an ethnic category, but what really matters is Judaism is a religious identity. So one of the aspects of being a religious Jew is that you have to be ethnically Jewish, but unlike normal ethnicity, I can't convert into being a black person. You can convert into being a Jew. So you can convert religiously into being a Jew, and then your bloodstream becomes part of the ethnic identity of Jews. The only reason that I talk about it as an ethnic identity is that in Orthodox Judaism, if your mom is ethnically Jewish, then you are Jewish by Jewish law. Mm-hmm. But it's not a perfect, you know, it's hard to say that it's a perfect ethnic group in the sense that it's a self-contained ethnic group when people can convert in. No one else can convert into an ethnic group. But this is why you have such diversity ethnically and racially among Jews.
Okay. Garrett says, how many hours per day do you read? On Monday's show, you mentioned that you read a 417-page biography in one weekend.
Yeah, so the Beethoven biography I actually read Friday night to Saturday morning. So that's so how many...
Did
how many?
Stay up all night long?
No, I went to bed relatively early, actually. Thank
so
God
you a
I read
speed
quickly.
Reader?
Yeah, okay. I'm not a speed reader, but I do read
okay.
fast. As far as how many hours a day I read, it really depends on what my kids will allow me. Most of my reading I get done on the weekends. So mm-hmm. Friday night and Saturday are really my big reading day. I would say that on a normal day, not counting the news, just reading books, anywhere from half an hour to an hour, maybe, if I'm lucky.
Okay.
But it depends on the day. I mean, if I'm working on another book, Like, I'm working on a book now, and that necessitates that I read a lot, so maybe a couple hours a day when I'm reading.
Able to know what this book is about?
I mean, the book is basically about why we're so angry at each other and why it is that we've lost a common vision for the country. And it goes all the way back to the roots of Western civilization and talks about why it is that we moved away from these roots. So we start literally at the Bible and Aristotle and move forward through Aquinas, Maimonides, and the founders, and then talk about the breakdown in Western civilization. Basically, the main thesis is that what built Western civilization was this idea of revelation on one hand, a godly universe on the one hand, and the power of reason on the other. And those were fused together with the idea of freedom in the American founding. And then the West decided that God was no longer part of this equation, was no longer necessary, and the next thing to fall was reason, and then the final thing to fall will be democracy. So that's the basic thesis.
And do you put this in layman's terms so people like myself can read it?
I hope so. I mean, that's the goal, yeah.
And TBD?
When it comes out?
Yeah.
I mean, it should be coming out 2019, so it's due the end of September 2018 with HarperCollins.
Yeah, people, well, congrats on that.
Well, thank you.
Looking forward to it. Just wanted to give those people watching a teaser because they hear, Ben, book, when's it coming
out? Yeah, exactly.
And get really excited. Megan Hansen says, hey, Ben, why did you go to D.C. a couple weeks ago?
I cannot say. It is mysterious, but it was cool.
I know.
It's true. Alicia knows.
I mean, I could give you my email address. No, I'm kidding. I won't let your secret out. Brandon, Ben, you've mentioned your disapproval of the Beatles. Oh, this is going to be fun. Emily in marketing, her ears just peaked because her husband is the biggest Beatles fan ever.
I know. We've had this argument.
Had this argument around the office many
times. As with everyone else in the office, she's very much on the edge of being fired over conversations like this.
So your disapproval of the Beatles, but what about Elvis? Good question. What are your favorite bands? And do you even like music at all? Are you human?
Okay,
I added the last part.
Thank you. I appreciate it. So today, actually, if you want to see the music that I recommended for today's news cycle, I tweeted out about 15 separate pieces. They're all classical.
Yes, I saw that.
So that's the classical music that I enjoy. But I also listen to old school jazz. Mm-hmm. In terms of rock,
did you save jazz? Are you responsible for saving jazz like Ryan Gosling is?
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Oh my gosh, it's a La La Land reference. Okay, continue.
Fine. God, Alicia, these random references. Okay, so in any case, as far as rock music, I like Doobie Brothers. I like some of the soft rock. I like Jim Croce. I like John Denver.
Okay.
I don't know Elvis's music enough to really critique it one way or another. I don't think that thrusting your pelvis is a skill set. I'm not sure that Elvis's pelvis was really a tremendous thing for Western civilization.
What about Bob Seger?
I don't know his music.
Lord have mercy. Okay, we'll get on that. I promise, folks, I'm going to try to humanize Ben.
Oh, no, it's Bob Saget, sorry.
Oh, God. Oh, goodness. So if people, you'd mentioned social media. You're on social media all the time. How many tweets a day do you send out?
I'm trying to minimize it now, but probably 40.
And if somebody wanted to become an expert, like in social media marketing, what should they do?
They should go to Skillshare. Are you looking to get a leg up at work and take your career to the next level? With over 3 million members, more than 17,000 classes, Skillshare is the Netflix for online learning. You can take classes in graphic design, DSLR photography, social media marketing, digital illustration, and a lot more. Skillshare classes, they are taught by the best experts, experienced professionals. These are all 45-minute classes, and they really are bite-sized, so you can get what you need and boil everything else out of the program. The fact is that I have taken classes in watercolors and social media marketing and various other topics. People around the office have also done this. Skillshare is giving my listeners a 1-month free trial of unlimited access to about 17,000 classes. All you have to do is go to skillshare.com/Shapiro. This is a great gift for Christmas, by the way, for folks. Skillshare.com/Shapiro to start your free month today. And once you start, you're not going to want to stop because it is going to increase your earning capacity as well. You need to increase your skill set. I'm constantly stressing this on the show. If you think that you're going to have a job in a month, you might not. That's why you need to increase your skill set. Live on the edge, but make sure that you have the skill set necessary to upgrade your salary.
Is that a threat?
No, Alicia, I would never threaten you.
I sometimes wonder when people put in their first and last name if I should really read their first and last name.
Yeah, because, I don't know. They might get fired.
Because I don't want them to get fired.
Let's go first name,
Let's just do Brendan here. Mr. Ben, when do you think it's okay to paint with a large brush?
When you have a big wall.
I liberals with gun owners and most right wings with how they feel.
Okay, so I think that generalizations can be useful, but you have to be careful with how specific you are being. So generalizations are useful in the sense that they're shorthand. Like people know what you're saying when you say that Republicans do X or Democrats do X or the left does X or the Y does Y, the right does Y. When you do that, people have a general idea of what you're saying, but always, when you use a generalization, everybody should read in their head, there are exceptions to this rule, this doesn't apply to everyone, unless you literally mean every single person who is a member of this subgroup believes this thing. And, you know, maybe we should clarify more often what that means, but I think that it is useful for shorthand, because otherwise you're going to spend an awful lot of time saying, you know, the group of which 79% believe A and 21% believe B, that group also breaks down further into this, like, in the end, we're all individuals, so if you want to use any sort of shorthand at all and not just talk about individuals, then you're going to have to generalize. There's just no way around it.
Okay, so generalization. But, I mean, do you think that the left or the right generalizes more?
Well, I mean, I think that the question isn't who does it more. The question is who does it wrongly. So I think that the right generalizes about the left a lot less inaccurately than the left generalizes about the right. I mean, the right's take on the left generally has been that the left is obsessed with the notion of libertinism, that at the same time they are communalists and communitarians, that they believe that group politics should predominate. That's endemic to left-wing thought. But right-wing thought is hard for the left to peg it down because they don't really understand founding philosophy all that well or haven't spent a lot of time with it. Mm-hmm. You'll find the odd person on the left who really does understand what conservatives think, but typically they just boil it down to they must be reactionaries. They identify the right with reactionary, and the right has a tendency to identify the left with badly meaning. I don't think that's badly meaning. I just think that they start from different premises that are wrong.
Okay. Paul says, hi, Ben. What do you think about the show The Twilight Zone? For me, it's the best show ever.
The Twilight Zone is fantastic. So every Thanksgiving on Sci-Fi Network, they show the full-on marathon of Twilight Zones.
Yep.
And there are a couple episodes that are truly great. If you've never seen The Howling Man is a personal favorite episode. That one is... The whole episode is basically the punchline of The Usual Suspects, right? The greatest trick the devil ever played is to teach you that he's not there. There are a couple other episodes that are really spectacular and very creepy. Really a great creative show, and we haven't seen anything I think probably as good since it was done. I would agree, that's got to be up there. If I had to pick top TV shows of all time, that one definitely has to be up there.
That'd be interesting. What age, because there is a creepy element to it, and I don't do good with scary things, at what age would you start showing your son and daughter episodes of Twilight Zone?
13, 14.
So that'll be the Shapiro stand. They'll be sitting on the couch at Thanksgiving at 13, and they're
I think that's right, yeah.
Okay.
The writing is really good.
Okay. Joe says, hey, Ben, I have used the situation to argue against government health care. One doctor is able to provide services to one of two men. One can pay and one cannot. Who would you save? Is this a false binary?
Well, I mean, it's not a false binary in the sense it's a false binary in the sense that typically the doctor can only save one person, and you wouldn't want to gauge that based on the level of money they have. Like, because you could see the left coming back with a variation on the binary in which they say, okay, one person can pay, one person cannot. The person who can pay happens to be Hitler, and the person who can't happens to be Mahatma Gandhi. Mm-hmm. Which one do you save, right? Do you let the money drive it? That's not really what the case is against government healthcare. The case against government healthcare is there's a certain number of people who may or may not want to become doctors. You can either pay them all $30,000, the people who want to become doctors, or you can have people buy their services and they will be paid $150,000. Mm-hmm. What do you think is going to generate more doctors? Or you have a queue, you have a line of people, and the doctor can spend a certain amount of time with each patient. How do you organize that line? Do you organize that line by basic supply and demand? Mm-hmm. Or do you organize that line by forcing the doctor to care for a certain person for a certain amount of time and shortchange everybody else? Because the fact is that what the market does, I mean, when it comes to medical care, very few people are really interested in overpaying for medical care. Very few people are actually like, I want to spend an extra $1,000 just to spend time with the doctor. Most people go into the doctor, get an answer, and leave. Mm-hmm. And the way that you determine how time should be spent is through a monetary transaction. Again, the end goal of that, in terms of from a moral point of view, would be to incentivize the creation of new doctors and create the predominance of more service.
Okay. So don't forget that the conversation is streaming live right now on the Daily Wire website, the Ben Shapiro Facebook page, and the Daily Wire YouTube channel. And you will be able to download it on SoundCloud like a regular podcast. It's free for all of our fans to watch and listen, but only Daily Wire subscribers get to ask Ben the questions. This is our second conversation we've done together.
It is.
And for those who didn't already pick it up, we are sitting in the Ben Shapiro studio, which is kind of cool.
That's true.
We just moved your big, like, Oval Office type desk out of the way.
And now we're sitting awkwardly on a couch.
I know. I don't know why they sit us on the couch. It's so weird. To ask questions, subscribe to the Daily Wire and log in to the website, then ask your questions in the comment chat box, which we will answer in the order that we receive them. Our team is working really hard to put them up here for Ben to answer as quickly as possible. Also, be sure to stay tuned for next month's conversation on Tuesday, January 16th, for the fifth episode of The Conversation starring our very own Andrew Klavan. It's the best way to kick off the new year, and he's lots of fun, so I'll have lots of fun hosting that once again. Sorry, guys, unless Ben's threat comes true and I'm not here next month, I will be hosting that episode of The Conversation. Let's keep moving. Robert says, Ben, a new subscriber. Welcome, Robert. What are your thoughts on Jordan Peterson's theory of religion as expression of archetypes?
Of Jungian archetypes. I think that his book's Maps of Meaning is a really interesting book. It's a little tough to read. It's a very dense volume. Jung's notion of the collective unconscious and the commonality of humanity with regard to religion, I think there is some truth to the idea that you see certain narratives that crop up in virtually every religion. And there's some scientific basis to this, that the human brain seeks a deity, that the human brain seeks God. The notion that all religion is a reflection of Jungian archetype, it seems to me the only problem there is that it sort of equates the value of each religion, and I don't think that that's exactly right. As a religious person, I wouldn't be able to say that I think every religion is equally valuable or equally correct. Otherwise, I wouldn't be a Jew. I would just be a devotee of all religion or a devotee of Jungian archetypes more generally. That may be, I hope I'm not oversimplifying Jordan's work. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's very sophisticated. It works like a 500-page book, and the pages are all this big. And but the notion of religion acting out deeper impulses in the human psyche, I think that's true. I agree with him there.
And I think, too, you've also spent a lot of your career talking about the impact that religions have had on cultures.
Well, 100%. I mean, the fact is that, as I say, my new book, some of it's going to be on the impact of Judeo-Christianity and its value system mm-hmm. on Western civilization. In fact, I made this argument to Sam Harris when we were sort of discussing / debating the other night. I think that podcast is coming out in a couple of weeks.
I heard it was pretty fun.
It was really interesting. So one of the key conversations was exactly this. Mm-hmm. I was saying to Sam, your entire worldview, your entire belief system is, it's atheist, both its atheism and its belief in a moral system are outgrowths of a Judeo-Christian foundation. And mm-hmm. Sam didn't really want to grant the point, but it's, my opinion, pretty obvious that that's the case, because obviously his hierarchy of values is very similar to my hierarchy of values. Mm-hmm. We come from completely different religious points of view. So that means that there is a culture that has inculcated a lot of the religious values that I hold dear, and that impacted Sam as well.
Interesting. Yay for Eleanor. I like the E names here. She says, hey, Ben, my question is very open-ended. Why does God exist?
Well, I mean, asking why God exists suggests that he's sort of a creation of our imagination. Mm-hmm. And God exists because God exists. I mean, that's like saying, why a chair? You could say that the chair was created for the purpose of you to sit on, but the whole point of God is that God wasn't created, God preexisted. So saying why does God exist is sort of the question. If you want to make it more interesting, you would say, why, from a human perspective, must there be a God? And the answer to that is that without a God, it's very difficult to imagine the notions of choice, hierarchy of values, free will, why reason should matter, mm-hmm. The notion of a morality that supersedes time and place. How do you get past the historicism of saying that every moral question is an outgrowth of the society of the era? You need a creator in order to make that happen. Also, this is another question that I was asking Sam pretty regularly, and he never really answered it, in my opinion. I don't know how, if you are an atheist, you get to a moral system, period. How do you get from an is to an ought? Mm-hmm. Right? Just like I say why God is like asking why a chair. The only way to answer why should there be a chair there is by saying, because there was a creator of that chair, and the creator of that chair intended for the chair to be sat mm-hmm. upon, because this is why he created the chair this way. And this is, if you read Aristotle, this is basically Aristotle's defense of natural law, right? Mm-hmm. Natural law theory is all based on this notion, this ancient Greek notion, that everything is created with a telos, that everything has a purpose. And the way that you can divine the purpose is by looking at the thing itself. So human beings have a purpose too, and that is to use our reason in the Greek idea. Well, if there's no creator, then, and it was all created by chance, then what purpose does a human being have other than we're just kind of walking around balls of meat that are defined by circumstance and genetics? And we have no will of our own. We have no mm-hmm. capacity to reason. Even if we do have a capacity to reason is just a higher brain function. But why is it a superior brain function? No one can really explain that. So if you want to build a system, it's impossible to build a system without the notion of purpose, and a purpose cannot exist without the notion of a God.
All right, moving along. Yakov is asking, hi, Ben, besides the White Sox, are you a fan of any other Chicago teams?
Yeah, I'm a Bears fan. I'm also a Blackhawks fan, although lesser. So I'm a major baseball fan. a minor football fan and an indifferent hockey fan. Although I do, when I've been to hockey games, I love them.
They're so fun.
They're great. I haven't spent the time to really get invested.
Yeah.
When you spend your entire childhood invested in baseball, getting invested in other sports is difficult. It's hard to pick up a sport and be like really invested in. So like, it's one of the things that's kind of gone by the wayside in the past few years is my following of sports. I used to subscribe to Sports Illustrated. I used to be really on top of it. And now my sports following has dropped pretty dramatically, unfortunately.
Is part of that because of your busyness here of, you know, being editor-in-chief at the Daily Wire? Or are you just annoyed with ESPN?
Well, I think some of both. So I stopped subscribing to Sports Illustrated after every other issue was about Caitlyn Jenner, who has not been athletically relevant since before I was born. And then obviously the political cycle takes away attention. Having kids takes away a serious amount of attention. And honestly, when it comes to baseball, one of the sad things about rooting for a team like the White Sox is that the White Sox only win the World Series once every 100 years. So they won it in 1917, and then the next time they won it was 2005. And after they won the World Series, if you spent your entire life rooting for a team to win the World Series, they finally win the World Series, it sort of takes the charm out of it. To a certain extent, because unless they're going to win every year, like, it's easy to be a Yankees fan, right? A Yankees fan, whenever Yankees fans complain, it's like, shut up, you won the last, like, oh, wow, it's so sad for you. It's been 5 years since your team won. My grandfather died without seeing the White Sox win the World Series.
I highly doubt that Cubs fans would agree with you, though, that it's not worth it to see them win.
Oh, no, it's definitely worth it to see them win, but I do wonder if Cubs fan have the same sort of feeling, that once the Cubs won the World Series, it was like some of the suspense went out of the
and
blue
now
a
what?
Little bit. Yeah, exactly.
Bunbury? I'm sorry if I mispronounce your name, but he or she wants to know, Ben, how can we curb the usurpation of power by the judiciary without the inevitable cries of Hitler? Is it even possible with a populace increasingly ignorant of basic civics?
So I think that judicial supremacy is a terrible idea. The idea that the judiciary gets to be the final arbiter of everything, I think is foolish, and I think it runs counter to the constitutional scheme. In Federalist, I believe, 78, it's Hamilton who talks specifically about the idea that if the judiciary should start to exercise will instead of judgment, that it would cease to support its rationale for existing in the first place. All too often, you see that happening with the judiciary. The real question that needs to be asked is, who do you think should control the future of the country, elected officials or people in robes who have been appointed and who have no relationship to the voter whatsoever? The judiciary was meant to be a check, but it wasn't meant to be the final say. And the idea that judicial supremacy should be the final say, I don't want Anthony Kennedy deciding the final say for me. I'd rather have Nancy Pelosi, because there's something I can do about getting Nancy Pelosi out of office. There's nothing I can do about getting Anthony Kennedy out of office.
Enric is asking, Ben, can a conservative laugh at liberal comedy like SNL, Chelsea Handler, Trevor Noah, etc., and still disagree with all their politics without being hypocritical? I mean, funny is funny, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you can definitely laugh at people who are on the left, and some of their comedy is really talented. I do have a tough time laughing when I know the premise of the joke is really false. Some of it is funny just because it's ridiculous, and if you can remove yourself from the political allegiance, then you realize that them making fun of Donald Trump, for example, even if you're a Trump fan, is still pretty funny, which is why I'll tell a joke about Trump, even though, you know, maybe I'm exaggerating something. A joke is a joke. But a lot of my favorite comedians are folks on the left, like Louis C.K. before his inevitable downfall. Some of his routines are absolutely hysterical, and I'm sure we would disagree about virtually everything political.
And I think it's interesting because I find most of the time that conservatives like you and I are more willing to watch SNL
It's 100% true,
people with left-leaning views and laugh at their stand-up routines and their performances, but people on the left aren't going to tune in and watch a conservative comedian.
That is definitely true. Anybody who is remotely on the right will immediately be discounted by the left because it's too offensive. It's too crazy. It insults their worldview. And so if here's the thing. When we laugh at the left doing the left's thing, it's because we understand that they're wrong, but what they're doing is still funny. When the left sees the right, what they see from us is they believe that we are representative of an evil worldview, and if they laugh, they are now complicit in the evil worldview.
That must be a really sad and unfunny way to live life.
I mean, I think that, honestly, like, I get a lot of, I get a lot of flack for, you know, you're constantly angry and cynical. The truth is, I'm a pretty happy fellow, just not publicly. So that's
and not towards other people.
Right, well, my family, excepting my immediate family.
TJ wants to know, hey, Ben, you ever wonder why we're here?
Like in this room to make money, but beyond that,
I think he means on Earth, in this universe.
On Earth, I mean, I've always felt that we are here to fulfill certain godly duties, and those duties are both discernible through human reason to a certain extent, and also discoverable through revelation.
Okay.
So, being a religious person solves a lot of these problems. But I think even if I were irreligious, I think that the purpose of being here would be to use right reason, as Aristotle would put it.
Okay. Do we have next question ready to go? Trying to roll through these as much as possible. Don't forget, only our Daily Wire subscribers are able to ask the questions, but anyone can be watching right now on the Ben Shapiro Facebook page, on dailywire.com, and on our YouTube channel. Also, you'll be able to download this later just like any other podcast via SoundCloud. I actually had a few people the last time we did the conversation together say that they listened to it on their drive home.
Nice.
In rush hour, in the Beltway, DFW, anywhere. So you can do that and send it to friends. Jesse wants to say, hi, Ben, will you ever tour Australia? Let's go.
Oh, I'd love to tour Australia.
You have a big following here, and you will love the weather.
So my understanding is that there are a couple of places that are looking to sponsor me to come to Australia. There's also a British tour in the works, mm-hmm. I think. And at some point, we'll probably do an Israel trip as well.
So. And I also think that we should do an episode of The Conversation there. I'm just saying.
I know, Alicia. I know you want us to drag you all over the place for free.
All over.
I know.
Not for free. Just, I mean, I've been to Australia, but I'd love to go back. I really like the people of Australia. It's great.
Okay. That's it.
I think that you actually might like the people there.
I mean, I like the Australians that I know. I don't know. So the only question is whether to bring the kids or not. 16-hour flights with children or...
I actually think... So my husband and I went there for our honeymoon, and I think it was 17 hours from LAX to Sydney.
Yeah. And I have a one-and-a-half-year-old, and he does not stop moving.
One-and-a-half-year-old boy.
Boy.
Like, a one-and-a-half-year-old girl.
Oh, she'd been calm. She'd been fine. Like, even now, we can take her on long flights. She's 3 and a half. No problem.
Yep.
He is just a ball of energy. He will not stop moving.
Which one of your kids do you think is more like you? Like personality-wise?
Probably her. Okay. She's very serious.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and you know my daughter.
Yes.
So she's very sweet, but there's also an undercurrent of contempt for the world that I really appreciate about her.
She occasionally gives me the same look her father gives me, which is
I love her. She's
Look of scorn.
The look of scorn.
Auntie Alicia often gets the look of scorn.
Yeah, and my son, I think, is probably more like my wife. He's a sweetie, but he's also very determined. Although I will say this, it's really funny. I think that both my kids have a real temper, and I am fairly certain it is not from me. Literally the other day we went down to Laguna Beach and we passed a parking spot and my wife did the thing that everyone hates where she got out of it was packed. She got out of the car, she stood in the parking spot because I was, you know, like two cars behind.
Yeah.
And some jerk was trying to like almost run her over and she gets back in the car and she's angry, like really mad about it and just going off. And my 3.5-year-old daughter then picks up that mommy's angry and starts going nuts about it. For 4 hours, every so often, she would just turn and say, that guy took our parking spot, and we found another parking spot. And I was like, sweetheart, this one's on you. This one's not on me.
You're like, so, that's from your genes, not mine.
That's exactly right, which is hilarious, because if you ever meet my wife, she's the sweetest person in the world.
She's a tiny, sweet, like, super kind person.
Right.
The opposite of you.
But that's exactly right. but she is Israeli, and there's a fire there.
There's an undercurrent of rage that can
that's
come
out. There's a quiet rage that comes out in the serial killer moments. But
Daniel says, hey, Ben, conservatives agree that businesses should be able to choose who they serve or not serve. Do you think this same principle applies to industries like hospitals? Should they be able to discriminate?
So my basic logic holds the same, meaning that, yes, you get to choose who to service and who not to service. Now, that has some pretty dire consequences mm-hmm. when it comes to hospitals, but the truth is that when you read the Hippocratic Oath, one of the whole things about being a doctor is that you are immediately assuming a particular burden. It's not a legal burden, but it is a moral burden. Mm-hmm. You'd be very hard-pressed to find a lot of doctors, either historically or currently, who would legitimately turn away sick people because they don't like their face or something.
Like, it goes against the Hippocratic Oath.
That's right. It's not a thing. So I mean, if it were to be a thing, then you know, I'm fairly certain other doctors would be available who would move into the neighborhood and put that doctor out of business. If you're a misanthrope doctor who's turning away large populations because you're just a piece of garbage, I think that you'd have a hard time. But that's it's endemic to the profession of being a doctor that you're going to take care of the person who's in front of you.
So we have a question from a Ben to a Ben. Dear Ben, what does the afterlife look like to you?
Well, it's a giant cheese ravioli, and all you do is you just eat it all day. But
what kind of sauce?
Well, marinara sauce.
Okay.
I love ravioli. But in any case, that's one of the things I miss about being slightly younger, when my wife and I would literally get like 2 bags of ravioli, like the 16-piece frozen ravioli, boil them, and eat the entire thing. Those were the days. In any case.
You can do that now.
Yes, but I'll be fat now. So, I actually have to care about that. As far as what an afterlife looks like, so the Jewish version of an afterlife, there's some debate on this.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been a little bit skeptical of people who claim to have a very solid read on the afterlife, since no one that in our religion, no one that we know of has really come back and mm-hmm. talked about it. So the basic idea of an afterlife that I've heard is basically bifurcated. There's the Talmudic idea, which is you sit around and you basically learn what God's structure was for the world, and you get to deconstruct everything that happened. Like there's different levels of heaven, and your scholarship determines where you were. There's a lot of tales in the Talmud about people who are in heaven talking over, you know, what basically learning, sitting around and learning.
So it's like seminary.
Kind of.
Okay.
Kind of. And then there's the version of heaven that is a little bit more Kabbalistic in nature, which is that you are basically absorbed back into God, that God granted you divine spark. When you die, that divine spark is reunited with God. Whether you may retain your individual identity, mm-hmm. But you are basically one with God at that point. And I find that a relatively compelling argument, considering that once your body is gone and your soul is still there, that I don't think that you just walk around in heaven. Heaven's basically just a nicer version of Earth. I don't think that. It's probably a difference in kind, not a difference in degree.
But either way, you're hoping there's cheese ravioli?
Well, there better be. I mean, otherwise, was keeping kosher worth it? I mean.
Lance says, how can I justify being against transgender people if I believe Mill's statements, the only power I can force on someone is to protect others, even if it is for their own good?
So the John Stuart Mill statement, if I'm getting that paraphrased correctly, was that you can only force on someone the ability to protect themselves, I guess. Mm-hmm. I think that to serve in the United States military is not just, it's not a right, it's a privilege. Mm-hmm. And this has been true for every military service in the history of man. If you are fat, if you are out of shape, if you are injured, if you are crazy, you don't get to serve in the military. If you suffer from depression, you don't get to serve in the military. Mm-hmm. Like, there are actual standards on joining the military. One of those standards seems to me that you should know whether you are a man or a woman, and that we should not have to be worried about whether you're going to undergo some sort of either surgical transition or significantly higher levels of depression and mm-hmm. suicidality in the military. That seems perfectly logical to me. But again, I think that the best people who are positioned to make those sorts of statements are the people who are permanently serving in the military, the people who are actually serving on the front lines. From what I can see from the polls of people in the military, they are very much against the idea of transgender troops in combat. The generals that I've talked to are not in favor of social engineering via the military. Now, I'm not going to sit there and force military policy. I think that all of what I just said is logical, but again, transgender people who want to join the military are doing something that I wasn't willing to do. Mm-hmm. And so all I can do is clap for their heroism. That said, that doesn't mean that I think the policy should be changed, that everyone who wants to join the military gets to join the military and has a right to join the military.
Okay. Tom says, hi, Ben, what's your opinion of Theresa May, especially with regards to the free speech in the UK as well as Brexit?
Well, I don't have a particular opinion on Theresa May just because I haven't watched her closely mm-hmm. enough. With regard to Brexit, I was in favor of Brexit. I think that the EU is an overbearing regulatory institution. I'm very much with Daniel Hannan mm-hmm. In this regard. As far as the free speech restrictions in the UK, those are extraordinarily heavy, mm-hmm. And those should be relieved as soon as possible. If I were to say half the things that I say today in the United States, in the UK, there is always the possibility I could be brought up on some sort of charges because they really crack down on what they perceive to be quote-unquote hate speech, which is really just the government arbitrarily deciding what speech should be allowed and what speech should not.
Chris says, hi, Ben. I hear you mention your discussions about free will versus determinism with your wife. What is your stance on that? I personally believe in free will and could use some Hebrew hammer points.
So I'm a big advocate of the idea of as if I'm trying to remember what the formal term is. Free will in which you could choose other than you have chosen.
Okay.
So you can choose differently than you did. So there's a bunch of different versions of free will. There's the compatibilist notion of free will, which is sort of the determinism and free will are both there. I don't think that that's really logical. There is the full-on Sam Harris version, which is the free will doesn't exist. You're a ball of meat wandering through the universe aimlessly, mm-hmm. And you don't really have the capacity to choose for yourself. There's free will maximalist, which is that your biology doesn't matter. And there's my position, which is your biology matters and constrains what you are capable of choosing. But in the end, you do have, to a certain extent, the capacity to choose. And that capacity to choose is what allows you to make your life better. And without that capacity to choose, all of morality breaks down, all of civilization breaks down. How can we determine what is... There is no concept of bad and good that does not rely on the notion of personal responsibility. Personal mm-hmm. responsibility cannot exist in a world where you're not responsible for any of your actions. Basically, some firing in your neurons is responsible for all of your actions. So free will is not only a requirement for civilization. I think it is a truth, and I think that, you know, people like to call it an illusion. And, you know, I've asked this to people, including Sam, who are on the determinist side, which is, so why are we sitting here? Mm-hmm. Like, other than we were just, I guess, forced to be here by circumstance, I guess we might as well enjoy it. Mm-hmm. What exactly compels people to come out to a theater and watch? What compels people to think about ideas? Why is reason a thing? Reason is just another brain function, so why should we stump for reason? Are you capable of changing anyone? You know, why shouldn't you sit around all day? And when they say, and if they say, well, you know, it's immoral to sit around all day, you say, well, what if your biology drives you to sit around all day? Mm-hmm. It's, I think that the human brain, let's say, for example, the determinists are right. I think the human brain is incapable of comprehending its own demise, the demise of mind, and the demise of individuality and reason.
Okay. So I think we're almost wrapping up. So you need to get in your questions now. You can do that by watching the streaming live on the Daily Wire website, the Ben Shapiro Facebook page, and the Daily Wire YouTube channel. And you'll be able to download the conversation later on SoundCloud, just like any other podcast, and listen to it over and over and over again if you so choose. It's free for all fans to watch and to listen, but only the Daily Wire subscribers get to ask the questions. And to ask questions, subscribe to the Daily Wire and log into the website right now. Then you can ask your questions in the comment chat box, which we will answer in the order that we receive them. Also, once again, be sure to stay tuned because next month I'll be sitting down on Tuesday, January 16th for our fifth episode of The Conversation starring Andrew Klavan. It's the best way to kick off the new year. You know, all the holiday parties are done. Maybe you're having to get back to the gym and diet and you're like, ugh, this is awful. Tune in and watch Andrew. He'll definitely cheer you up.
Okay, I was just looking for exit polls. I see no exit polls in Alabama yet.
Oh, okay, so. Is that why you're over? I thought you were really
doing.
Bored with
I wasn't
my,
just
like...
bored with you and, I mean, not only bored with you, but...
Tiffany says, hi, Ben. I am a religious Southern Baptist, and I wanted to know the reasoning behind practicing kosher eating standards and what they are.
Okay, so the textual reason is that a lot of it is right there in the text of Leviticus, right? Mm-hmm. So when it talks about not eating shellfish, or when it talks about not eating meat and milk together, what it really says is don't eat a kid in its mother's milk. All of these things are directly from the text of the Bible. The basic logic to them is very often about separation. So Judaism is very much about is about kedusha. Okay, so there's a root in Hebrew, a little bit of Hebrew lingo for y'all. It's kuf dalad shin, and what it means is separation. So it's used for weddings. So when you are mikdash someone, when you have kedushin, that's a wedding. So mm-hmm. that separates your life when you're single from the time after. When you are sanctifying the Friday night meal, you do kiddush, right? Same root of the word, and that's to sanctify the meal, to separate that meal from all the other meals, and to separate Sabbath from weekdays.
Okay.
So the same thing is true for kosher. The kashrut is all about the idea of separating the clean from the unclean, separating the pure from the impure. And so, for example, the separation between meat and milk is all about the idea that milk represents life and meat represents death. And you shouldn't mix the two because death does not exist in life, nor does really life exist in death. The idea being that these are two separate things and you should keep them separate. So Judaism is very much about that. And then, you know, on the back of that, there's some practical concerns that people now obviously bring up, but they weren't relevant morally. You know, there's all the people who say, well, you don't eat pig because of trichomoniasis and this kind of thing. And maybe that was the case, but God doesn't say so. So I'm not going to attribute, you know, scientific rationales to God where he doesn't try to make them himself.
I'm just sad you can't have bacon.
I keep hearing this. Beef bacon's pretty good, but...
No.
I've taken you to the candied beef bacon. Had the candied beef bacon at like La Gondola over here in L.A.?
No.
Oh, really?
No.
Okay. Damn it, I have to buy you some.
Ah, gotcha. Yeah, you are getting me a Christmas gift after all.
And it's fake bacon.
Catalina is asking, hey, Ben, what do you think about the peace deal between FARC and the Colombian government? I live and am stuck in Colombia, and it feels like we will turn into Venezuela anytime
soon. So I am going to plead ignorance on this because I do not know too much about the current situation in Colombia. I do know that FARC is a bunch of communist insurgents who ought to have been wiped off the map long ago. And any peace deal with a terrorist group usually ends badly for the government in power. So those are my broad line thoughts. But again, I'd want to study a little more to give you a more specific answer.
And we hope for it seems like all of Central America, like Guatemala, Colombia,
it's a disaster area right now.
It's not good.
No, it is not.
And I mean,
it's one of the reasons why the illegal immigration problem is such a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, people are literally fleeing from countries that are hellholes.
And sending their children over.
Yeah.
That was something that we saw here in Los Angeles, specifically in Southern California a couple years ago, when people were sending their children over and then they were having to set up these camps, like in the middle of San Diego County.
Yeah.
And they weren't just people, I think it was assumed that, they're all Mexican immigrants, but they weren't.
No, a huge percentage of immigrants now are coming from Central and Latin America, not directly from Mexico.
Okay, don't forget, if you are a subscriber, log in and you can ask us questions. And hello to all the people watching on Facebook. But if you're commenting in the comments and you're trying to ask questions and they haven't been asked, it's because you're not asking the right way. Because you need to become a subscriber and go to thedailywire.com and enter your questions in the chat box. Okie dokie. So AJ says, hey Ben, a friend of mine came to me because he was having trouble with an assignment for class. The assignment was to create his own terrorist group. What? They do this in school now? Is there any advice you could give to my friend?
Yes. So what he should do is he should declare a terrorist group, and the terrorist group should be based on certain fundamental principles. It should be based on low taxation, non-importation of tea. and various other anti-government activities. But the only government he should be formally opposing is a foreign-dominated government from overseas that refuses to accelerate representation for such taxation.
Okay.
That seems to me like an awesome terrorist group. If I were going to start one, we'd also wear tri-cornered hats, and we'd have really cool coats, and everything would be pretty awesome. We'd be better writers than current terrorists. I think that's a pretty good terrorist group.
And depending on the professor, he might actually think that that's a dangerous group of terrorists.
He would. He'd just call them Tea Partiers, but they would actually be like the original ones.
Alexi says, hey, Ben, do you think there is any hope for the Russian Federation? It really seems that every year it moves closer to a third world dictatorship.
I mean, the only real hope is for, there is a real nostalgia that's been built up in Russia around the idea that Russia was a world power. When the Soviet Union was a world power, it was still a hellhole, mm-hmm. and there was this tremendous misimpression, I think, that was created. There's a fantastic book. I've recommended it on the show before, and its name eludes me for the moment. I think it won the Pulitzer Prize a few years ago. But basically, it's retellings of all these experiences that people have had in Russia from the beginning of communism till now. Mm-hmm. And what you sense is a real nostalgia among a lot of Russians for a time when Russia was a world power, and when the Soviet Union collapsed, there was a belief that that Russia was going to turn into America overnight, that basically it was going to go, because it was a world power, and then the government that was spending all the money on the military collapsed, then now everything was going to flip a switch, and we're world power, why shouldn't we still be a world power? And instead, Russia turned into a second-rate power. And the desire to be seen again as a force in world history continues to be very strong in Russia, and that's enabled a lot of bad people like Vladimir Putin, who is constantly trying to demonstrate to his public that he is increasing Russian power in the world. Once that ends, once people begin to realize that world status matters a hell of a lot less than whether you can take care of your family, and this becomes a widespread belief, then that would be better. Also, there's just not rule of law in Russia. I mean, there actually needs to be a government that comes in and breaks the oligarchy at the top, and that's there are a lot of mistakes that were made in the 90s and the early 2000s with regard to the government basically taking what was left over, whatever assets were left over, and redistributing them to quote-unquote private industry, who are really just friends of the government.
Okay. Jared is in Phoenix, I'm guessing, and he says, hey, Ben, I'm waiting for marriage before I have sex. How do I find a girl that does not only want to have... Oh, how do I find a girl that does not only want to have sex? I'm in college.
Okay, so first of all,
I think that end part is like really sad.
Right,
it's like, it's a no man's land. I'm in college.
Okay, so first of all, good for you, Jared. I have not found it to be the case that that women in college are desperate for sex. I think this is a male fantasy that women are constantly desperate for sex all the time.
Mm-hmm. Seth Rogen, Zac Efron movies.
Right, I mean, if only it were so, says every man ever, right? I mean, the idea that women are desperately looking for sex in the same way that guys are, I don't think is true. As far as finding a girl who's not looking to have sex before marriage, go to church. I mean, honestly, like go to a place where people agree with you ideologically and in terms of virtue. That's the best place to start. But I mean, these are questions that my wife and I legitimately asked each other on our first dates. I mean, I remember asking my wife if she was a virgin.
Oh, you mean you didn't ask? She didn't ask you the 10 questions from feminists that
Giacomo
wrote about
yesterday?
No,
and she asked me whether I was a virgin. Like, these were important things to both of us, and because these were important, and it wasn't important because I hold some sort of outsized value with regard to virginity. The reason that it was important to me is because what this said is that sex was supposed to be inherently connected with a deeper relationship than a relationship of marriage, and that she took sex seriously, she took commitment seriously, and she took intimacy seriously. Not because I think that, once you have sex, you're sullied or something like that. I don't think that's right.
Okay. Ryan Thompson says, hi, Ben. I was raised as a Reformed Jew, but I'm interested in exploring other sects of Judaism, such as conservative or Orthodox. What should I consider in exploring these other sects?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, if you are a Reformed Jew, then you probably have not had a lot of experience with the Bible itself. You probably have not had a lot of experience with Judaic thought. A lot of Reform Judaism is based around social justice warrioring. If you want to start with good books to read that are literate and interesting about Orthodox Judaism, I think Jonathan Sachs is quite good. Aryeh Kaplan is quite good. Both of them are Orthodox rabbis and take secularism very seriously. Aryeh Kaplan was a rocket scientist. Jonathan Sachs is the chief rabbi of Israel, of Great Britain, or was for a while. And starting with an adherence to the Bible is the first thing. But so read the Bible and then read commentaries on the Bible, because the fact is that one of the straw men that's been built up is that everyone who is a Bible believer takes every word of the Bible absolutely literally. I know virtually no one in the Orthodox community who takes every word of the Bible 100% literally, because if you did, then you'd be a Sadducee, not a Pharisee, right? I mean, to take the old distinction that I think is actually misaligned in the New Testament, the reality is that Pharisaical Judaism is just Rabbinic Judaism. Sadducees were folks who tried to take the Bible as literally as possible, and you end up in some pretty weird places if you do that.
Mm-hmm. Robert says, Ben, what evidence do you have that the free market will be able to provide affordable, good health care for those on minimum wage?
So the evidence is just that every other product that has ever been provided in the history of man has become more affordable in a free market, and healthcare should not be an exception to that rule. The only thing that health insurance is not going to be necessarily more affordable, but healthcare will be more affordable. Mm. So there is a difference. Health insurance is about insuring you against future loss. If you're already sick, I'm not insuring you against future loss. I'm paying you to be sick. Mm-hmm. That's not the same thing. When it comes to healthcare itself, the prices will go down in every area of healthcare when there is open competition and full transparency. And that can only happen in a fully privatized market. The case in point of this would be laser eye surgery. Laser eye surgery is not insured. The cost of laser eye surgery went from like $20,000 an eye to about $5,000, $4,000 an eye. Mm-hmm. It's widely available. You can get it on demand. The reason for that is because it's a free market system.
I haven't done any of these things.
Neither have I, but...
But I mean, like things like Botox, plastic surgery, elements like that that are also not. I know. For my 40th, maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
Next, we have a question from Ring, who says, hey, Ben, do you have any advice for a young lawyer looking to transition into political commentary or writing? Sounds like kind of wanting to make the transition that you made. I thought you would have some uniquely good insight on this, and thanks. Love the show.
Okay, so the answer is write for free. So everybody wants to be paid up front. Everybody wants to make a living up front. How do we become a paid columnist or paid pundit? Mm-hmm. The answer is you don't. You start off writing for free. Pretty much everyone who's written for us has started off on a trial basis writing for us either for free or for kind of a day wage because we pay people while they try out. You need to actually get your foot in the door. Just like anything else, if you're going to apprentice at a place, you have to have an apprenticeship. You don't just jump in full-fledged. No one takes your opinion seriously unless you spend a lot of time in the minors. It's really funny because, you know, thank God, I think that my exposure has increased pretty radically since 2012 when we first started working together. But before 2012, I was working in this business since 2003.
Yep.
So, I mean, pretty much everyone in the conservative commentariat who is a success became an overnight success after 15 years of hard work being a nothing in the industry. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fairly common across all industries, right?
Yep.
You labor and you labor and you labor, and then suddenly you break through.
And then it's like, where did they come from?
Right, exactly.
But you've been there all along.
And the answer is reading books for two decades, right? That's where I was, yeah.
That's why you're so smart. We only have a few minutes left, so we're going to try to roll through all these as quickly as possible. You mentioned on Monday that the kid that was being bullied should beat up bullies. You also mentioned not punching people. Can you explain the difference? Is it only if it is physical bullying?
Yeah, it's only if it's physical bullying. So okay. If people call you names or if they're mean to you, you don't get to punch them. But if somebody punches you, you should beat the living hell out of them.
Okay.
So that is my considered take on the issue. It is good to grow a thicker skin. People can be nasty and cutting and horrible, but there is a difference in kind between speaking nastily about somebody and physically hitting them. I know the difference. Both have happened to me.
Yeah.
And it is imperative that you know the difference, because otherwise, number one, you'll be wrong, and number two, you'll get in trouble.
Well, and sometimes it's hard because you obviously were the chief receiver of awful threats and stuff during the 2016 election cycle. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's, those are technically verbal assaults, but at what point should you be legitimately afraid that they could become worse?
I mean, when there's an open threat of violence, that's a slightly different thing. And people take it differently, right? And it's the difference between saying something mean and actual assault, right?
Yep.
Assault, illegally speaking, assault is a threat of violence, a credible threat of violence. So if I were to, swing my fist at your face and then stop an inch short, that's an assault. If I were to let it hit you, that would be battery, right? People mix these two terms up. Mm-hmm. But the same thing is true with regard to a death threat. If somebody sends me a threat saying, I'm coming to your house at 3 a.m. to kill you, or I'm going to kill you, then that's an actual assault. It's not just free speech at that point.
Ethan says, hey, Ben, I love the show. How can we address equal opportunities for black men as father figures when they suffer job application disparities?
So the evidence on job application disparities is actually relatively scant. There have been a couple of studies that have been done. One suggests that when you submit your name and the name is DeQuante or something that people identify as culturally black, then you're less likely to get a job. But there's another study that basically suggests that black and white have nothing to do with it. It has to do with the culture, right? So DeQuante is going to get a job application approved far less often than Brian Johnson, if Brian Johnson's a black guy, even if it's Brian Jefferson, and Jefferson's a typically black name in the United States. So the reason for that is that job interviewers are going to seek any information they can about you. This holds true, by the way, in every community, right? If I were to call myself Benjamin as opposed to Benjamin, I'd get a different class of people who look at me. Right, it's just a fact. Like people treat each other differently based on their names because they try to learn culture from names, but you can't really do that just from a last name per se. As far as job disparity, I think that job disparity really does not occur at the middle and upper class. It doesn't even occur in the lower class for people who are applying for jobs for which they are qualified.
Mm-hmm.
The black single motherhood rate, the poverty rate among black two-parent families is 6% in the United States. The the single white mother poverty rate is 22%, or was as of a few years ago. So the idea that black fathers cannot get jobs, I don't think is right unless they have, for example, a criminal history or a worse resume.
Okay. Hunter says, and this is our last question, Hunter says, hey, Ben, do you think that Trump will continue to push conservative policies as his administration continues or give in to Democrats?
Well, I've given up on trying to predict the president. So I think that, you know, he is, I don't think that he is at root a conservative. Mm-hmm. He doesn't speak conservatism. That said, all the people around him are conservative, or at least some of them are. And that means that the last 3 weeks of policy have been extraordinarily conservative, some of the most conservative policy I've ever seen in my time covering politics. Mm-hmm. A lot is going to depend on the situation surrounding him. Let's say he loses the House in 2018. If he loses the House in 2018, I think you could see him tack significantly to the left in an attempt to work with Democrats, but only if Democrats are willing to work with him. If not, you could see him tack to the right. One of the reasons he's moved to the right is because he feels his only base of support is with the right. And so that being the case, him being alienated by everyone else and only supported by people on the right, he's going to try and please his base. So that's a good thing. I mean, I think for executive policy, that's a good thing. But he's going to need to win over some people in the middle if, number one, he hopes to win re-election, and number two, if he hopes to actually pass any major legislation beyond what is always sort of the gimme for Republicans of the tax cut.
I can't believe this wasn't asked, but what do you think our chances are of holding the House in 2018?
Not good. I mean, I would put it at maybe 40% right now.
Okay.
You know, I don't think it's like 30 or 20%, and a lot can happen between now and then. But given the enthusiasm gap and the fact that it's an off-year election, presidents typically lose 23 seats in an off-year election. We only have a 23-seat majority now, or 25-seat majority now. I'd say it's a pretty good shot we lose. Although the only countervailing evidence is that all the districts have basically been polarized. There are not a lot of purple districts anymore. Yeah. There are a lot of red districts and a lot of blue districts.
And we do not have any exit polls yet from Alabama. But
not as far as I know.
Everybody should be watching Twitter. And stay tuned next month on Tuesday, January 16th, for the fifth episode of The Conversation, starring our very own Andrew Klavan and hosted by me. Ben, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you so much.
We appreciate it. And thank you for watching. Be sure to keep up with The Daily Wire, like our Facebook page, our YouTube channel, all that fun stuff. Oh, and by the way, you can download this episode and listen to it on SoundCloud and share with friends. I'm Alicia Krauss. Thank you so much for watching.